Okay, everybody. My name is Paula Stutman, and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art. And my lecture today is on the history of public art at Rockefeller Center. The image you're looking at right here is a drawing of Rockefeller Center made representing the center between 34 and spring 1937. Now, the Museum of Modern Art opens November 7th, 1929, and the three founding members of MoMA are Lily P. Bliss, Mrs. Cornelius J. Sullivan, and Abby Aldridge Rockefeller.
We can't hear.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, how's that? Is that better? Okay, so Abby Aldridge Rockefeller, who you're looking at right here, was one of the founding members of the Museum of Modern Art. Now, in 1928, a year before MoMA opens, her husband, J.D. Rockefeller Jr., will enter into a project to rebuild the Metropolitan Opera House on a parcel of land in Midtown Manhattan that was owned by Columbia University. He enters that project in 1928. After the crash, the Metropolitan Opera House leaves the project, and Rockefeller Jr. is really left holding the bag. And he will develop what we know today as Rockefeller Center on that plot of land. Now, the original 14 buildings go up in between 1932 and 1940. And all of the original 14 buildings were made out of Indiana limestone. Now, and that's important to keep in mind, because the Indiana limestone is beautiful, but the art also really augments that Indiana limestone. It tended to look a little gray. Now, from the very beginning, there was money set aside for an art program at Rockefeller Center. And I just want to show you this image. This image is a stage publicity photograph, and it includes some of the architects who were responsible for the project, as well as the managing agent, John Todd. And I just want to point out, Raymond Hood, whose imprint is really on Rockefeller Center, one of the architects, and John Todd, who was the managing agent. And if you want to think of them as characters in a movie, you can think of John Todd as James Cagney, and you can think of Raymond Hood as George Clooney in a flannel suit, okay? Got strong personalities involved. The art committee was a committee. It went through a committee, and it went through the architects, it went through the managing agent, and it went through John D. Rockefeller Jr. as well. Now, originally, they did hire a professor, Professor Hartley Burr Alexander. He was a professor of philosophy at Scripps College in the University of Southern California. Raymond Hood brought him into the project, and he will write a proposal titled Rockefeller City, Thematic Synopsis, where he was a 32-page proposal where he proposed a variety of ideas. He didn't last very long. His ideas were a little over the top for a commercial project, but what is interesting is his ideas do filter down to the works that end up in the project. In the end, Rockefeller Center settles on a theme called the New Frontiers of Man, or Man in Progress, and it fit the buildings as well as the artwork. The idea is that they were building a complex that was a new complex for the 20th century. It would have the best that technology could offer at the time, and the artwork would also fit within the theme showing the progress for humanity in the best possible light. So I'm not going to be able to show you everything at Rockefeller Center, but I'll give you some of the highlights of the artwork there. First, I'm starting off with a piece from Radio City Music Hall, which is one of the only two pieces that adorn the outside of Radio City Music Hall. And I also want to bring up that there were two men who were also involved in the art project. One of them was Leon V. Salon, and he was in charge of putting together the artworks on the outside of the buildings to make them come together in harmony so that they would all fit together. So he had a say in what the works looked like that were on the outside of the buildings. Edward Trumbull, who was also an artist, was in charge of overseeing the works inside the buildings, except for Radio City Music Hall, which was under the eyes of Donald Deske. He was in charge of Radio City Music Hall. He was interior designer, a furniture designer, and that was his baby. And so Radio City Music Hall has only two works that go on the outside. One of them we're looking at right here is by Hildreth Meir. And Hildreth Meir's piece, there's three of them, and the one we're looking at here is Dance. All of them are circular, all of them are the same size, all of them are quite high off the ground, and yet you have a good perception of them when you're standing on the street level because of the way they're made. They're made out of cast aluminum, brass, chrome, nickel, steel, and enamel. And they show the three elements that form a great musical, or a great theater. And of course we see Dance right here. Well, you have the figure dancing. It's really in the Art Deco style of the time period, with the decorative qualities you see happening. And notice how it works with that Indiana limestone, which we can see behind the object. It works quite well. The fabricator of these pieces was Oscar Bruno Bock, and it's important to mention his name because the work had to last. It was going to be on the outside of a building. It would be experiencing all the elements of an East Coast city, and he was actually known for creating, he actually patented a certain element that was responsible for preventing enamels from not corroding under the elements, and that was one reason he was chosen to be the fabricator for this piece. So here is dance. Here is drama, and of course you have that goddess-like figure in the center, and the two women that flank her are holding the two masks of the theater. And look at the decorative touches, how absolutely beautiful they are, the scarf behind her. All three pieces are brought together by the circular design around them. They're similar in all three works. And the way I'm showing them to you, if you go to Rockefeller Center, let's say you're starting on 6th Avenue, and you're walking, and Radio City is towards your left as you walk towards 5th, this would be the second one you would see, and this would be the third one, closest to fifth song, where you have the young woman dancing, and you have the gentleman, the young man playing the music, and she is singing. Sometimes this is confused with dance, but this is song, okay, and the silver birds flying around. The other piece I'd like to show you from Radio City Music Hall is a piece by Stuart Davis. And Stuart Davis, this is a piece that's called Untitled today, but originally one of its titles was Men Without Women, was what it was known for, but Davis did not like that title. It's an oil on canvas, and it's actually in the men's room. The men's lounge, which used to be the smoking lounge, okay? This different time period. It was in the main men's lounge, and what you're seeing in the image, it's actually an oil on canvas, and if it's hard to read the image in my projection, look at the bottom third. They actually put a stainless steel and plexiglass barrier to keep you away from the work. But what it is, it's a work that does not represent figures, but it represents things men love to do in their leisure time, such as smoking, pumping gas for their cars. There's a tobacco pouch. There's playing cards. You can see a pipe, barber poles. Davis was paid $800 for this work. At one point, this work was removed from Radio City Music Hall, and it was brought to the Museum of Modern Art. And after Radio City Music Hall went under a restoration, it was reinstalled where it originally hung, and that's where it is today. And you should really check it out. It's quite beautiful. And actually, originally, he was thinking of doing a linoleum print, but it was too limiting, and he ends up doing it in oil on canvas. But it has that quality, maybe, of a print. It's rather flat in the way that it's represented in the work. A piece that's probably well known to a lot of us is Paul Manship's Prometheus, which is installed in 1934 in the Lower Plaza. And they had a lot of problems with the Lower Plaza. And when I talk about the Lower Plaza, I'm talking about the skating rink. And the skating rink was not there in the beginning. And one of the problems with the Lower Plaza in the beginning, because what it did originally, it doesn't do it today, but originally their dream was you would walk down Fifth Avenue, you'd go into the Lower Plaza, you'd spend all your money in all the shops in the underground, and then you'd walk above ground and continue spending money. Because remember, it is a commercial complex. Unfortunately, people did not go down and spend money, and eventually they settled on the ice skating rink because it turned out to be quite popular with the public. But it was important to put a sculpture there that would draw the public into the space. So Paul Manship was chosen, and one of the reasons the architects chose Manship, he was very well known at the time, and he was also known for his speed and getting things done on schedule and within budget, which was very important to everyone involved. And Prometheus is the piece that he creates based on the Greek legend of Prometheus, who brings fire down from the heavens to help us, to help mankind, and then is punished, and his liver is plucked by vultures every night until he's rescued from that situation. And behind Prometheus, engraved on the wall, is the following quote: "Prometheus, teacher in every art, brought the fire that hath proved to mortals a means to mighty ends." And it is a large bronze sculpture. He's resting on Mount Olympus. You can see him holding the flame that he brings to us, and there is a close-up of his face. Now, unfortunately, the press did not like Prometheus when he was first installed. They thought he looked rather ugly and disappointing, and he ended up with the nickname Leaping Louis, because for many, it looked like he had leapt right out of the main building. Remember, 30 Rock, the tallest building, stands behind Prometheus, and it looked like he had just leapt out of the building right into the fountain. Originally, there was a fountain installed with Prometheus. It was part of the original idea. But the fountain that's there today is not the original one, but it's quite beautiful. And actually, you should go watch it because the patterns change for the water. They go up and down. There's a rhythm to it, and they really suit Prometheus. In the beginning, Prometheus did not have the gold gilding you see on him today. They originally left his surface in its natural bronze state, but they talked. Remember, there's meetings going on every week at Rockefeller Center what to do. That's involving everyone, including the artists. And Prometheus was left ungilded for about 3 years when they finally decide to cover him in gold. What they use is gold leaf. And they're using Italian-made 23-karat gold leaf, and he has been re-gold leafed quite a few times since he was installed. And actually, he was recently re-gold leafed, I think it was before skating season this year, because I did wander down to Rockefeller Center, and when you do gold leaf a sculpture, they have to put a shed or some kind of covering over the sculpture because the gold leaf is very vulnerable to the elements, to dust, to anything blowing around, and to protect it while they do it, they had to cover it up. But you could see fluttering around the area little pieces of gold. And he looks great after he's been re-gold leafed. You know it right away. So he is in all his glory. And even though he had a rough start in the beginning with the nickname Leaping Louis, he's really well loved by the public. Though Paul Manship did not really care for the sculpture. It wasn't his favorite work. The International Building. You're looking at the work here that's on the International Building, and it's on the side entrance. It's on the side entrance of 30 Rock. It's on 50th Street, the entrance we're looking at right here. And it's a work by Lee Laurie. And it has two different titles that come up when you talk about this work. One of them is The Purpose of the International Building, or another title that it goes under, The Story of Mankind. One of the themes that they did with their buildings in Rockefeller Center, there's an international theme with the buildings. There's the French building, there's the British building, there's the Italian building, and there's the International Building. And the reason they came up with this idea was it was a great way to rent space. You have the Italian building, you can generate Italian businesses to come in your space. You want to remember this isn't being built during the Depression. And I did forget to mention to you that in the beginning, they set aside $150,000 for the art project. There was money set aside. In the end, they spend $1 million during its depression, $1 million during the Depression. So they want to rent space. That's the bottom line for Rock Center. So you have these different international buildings, and then you have the International Building, the second tallest one of the original buildings. And they generated travel-related businesses into the International Building. Originally, if you walk in on Fifth Avenue, you'll see the mezzanine area, and that originally was rented to the U.S. Passport Agency. So keeping within that theme of the International Building in terms of commercial projects. But the theme with the artwork falls under an international theme as well, thinking of the idea of people coming together. This is a work that looks like hieroglyphics or a pictogram, and I'm going to just start you here with the bottom image, which shows the four races of men, and they're described in their various shades of skin tone. Starting on the left, you have red, white, yellow, and black, and they're on the bottom area of the piece, so they're right. I'm going to point right there. Then you have this right over here, which represents international commerce, the ships sailing the seas. You have Mercury, the god of commerce, right over here. You have the sun right over here above everything. And it's something that every people shares all over the world. It's the sun, it's represented by the clock, but we all share the element of time. In a way, it was a way of bringing people together from wherever we are or from wherever we come from. Other images in that work, too, are the star formations you see right below here. You have right over here, it's representing the different hemispheres. You have the Big Dipper, and you have, excuse me one second, You have the Big Dipper right over here and the Southern Cross on this side. So trying to show things that we all share as a people, though we might come from different places. So then that fits in with the theme of man in progress and new frontiers as well, as people coming together. And the other thing about this work, too, it's a limestone work. That's a polychrome limestone work, and there, so it's painted. And it's also a relief work. So when you see this area, like in the stars, that's an empty space. And what happens at night, it's often lit up from the back. It's quite beautiful. And that's gilding as well within the work. Now, Atlas, I think he's as well known as maybe Prometheus. And Atlas is made by... Lee Laurie was the person who designed Atlas, but René Paul Chamberlain was the person who fabricated Atlas. Atlas is a large bronze work. It's actually the largest work in the complex, and it stands in front of the International Building on the Fifth Avenue entrance, right across from St. Patrick's. Now, this was a really special area, and there was a lot of limitations that Lee Laurie had to face when he designed this sculpture. For one thing, they knew the address they had. They knew their building was across from St. Patrick's. It was a prime address. And they wanted a sculpture there, but they did not want a block passageway for pedestrians, and they did not want to block views. And it's a, if you're unfamiliar with the International Building's front entrance on Fifth, it's a narrow, shallow space. So he had to work within that. He builds Atlas, and Atlas, coming from the Greek myth, is doomed to bear the heavens and earth on his shoulders for all eternity. And what he does is really quite smart, in that the open shape that's the heavens upon his shoulders is an open shape, which makes it look rather light and gives you a lot of space in that area. Now, I want to show you the way it's in this image. You have Atlas, and it's made out of bronze, and it's hollow inside. It's held together with pins. And there's a steel structure in here that holds up Atlas. And the column was designed by the architects. And today, if you go down to Rockefeller Center, it's not just in the original design for the piece. It was just one narrow column that bared the weight of Atlas, which must have looked rather remarkable, because it's a big sculpture. You notice his foot is leaning over the column. But today what they did is there's flower boxes as well on the lower third of that column, so it makes it wider. And the flowers are beautiful as well, but it's a different effect. Now, the other thing about Atlas is his relationship to St. Patrick's. They knew St. Patrick's was across the street. If you ever look at photographs of the design for the International Building, you can see that the foundation is parallel to St. Patrick's. If you have the opportunity and you see the front doors of St. Patrick's open, go in and go down the center aisle. Get as close to the altar as possible and swing around. Atlas is in line with the altar of St. Patrick's. It's an amazing view, and you knew he was thinking about it. He was very much aware of that when he made the sculpture. Here's a back view of Atlas as well. The one image I do not have to show you is a close-up of his face, but go down. It's right down the street. Go visit. Look at his face. Part of his history is that he was picketed by the public in the 1930s. They thought he bared an uncanny resemblance to Benito Mussolini, who was the leader of Italy at the time. Moving along, we are looking at the Italian Building. And this is a work that's no longer there. Attilio Piccarilli's Advance Forever, Eternal Youth, which was installed in 1935 and destroyed in 1949. Now, the Italian Building, of course, it was an idea to generate businesses internationally, a great way to rent space during the Depression. And they were hoping to attract cultural offices and make it a commercial cultural center for Italian commerce. And that was their plan. And Piccarilli was a very well-known artist, and his studio that he ran with his brothers, probably their best well-known work that they made, they were the artists that fabricated the large Lincoln in Washington, D.C. by Daniel Chester French. And this work, actually, it no longer exists, but what it was made out of, it was made out of Pyrex glass blocks that were cast by Corning Glassworks. And they were slightly translucent, not 100% translucent, but they were almost milky, so to speak. And they were put together with a special kind of adhesive that had just been developed at the time that was translucent as well. Now, unfortunately, this work ran into some issues and some problems. For one thing, the statement, advance forever and eternal youth, was a statement that was a slogan used by Mussolini. Also, the statements that run down the side of the work as well, art is labor and labor is art, were other statements and slogans that were used by Mussolini. And also the image of that figure, that young man, the muscular figure working away, a neoclassical approach to figurative work, was the type of artwork that was associated with fascism. And also what we don't see here too, carved above the entranceway of this building into that Indiana limestone, was the Fascist Party's logo of a bundled axe and rod. And the images had become quite disturbing to the Italian tenants in the building. And in 35, the tenants quietly lobbied the complex for their removal of these works. And what happened in 1941, the works, the glass work and the carving above it, was boarded up, and the public could no longer see it. And the building was renamed International Building South for the duration of the war. And then it did return to its original name after the war. And when the war ended, at the request of the Italian government, the carving and the glass panel were removed. And during the removal, the carved work was smashed and the glass panel was stored somewhere. And according to Christine Roussel's book about the artwork of Rockefeller Center, she states that the work was destroyed. And she has worked as a conservator in Rockefeller Center for quite a while. And she states that the work was destroyed in 1949. Now, in 1973, Corning Glassworks attempted to locate the work, and the center responded by saying the work had been lost. And you can still see images of the work. Now, what they did reinstall in 1965 above that entranceway, which you can go see today, is Giacomo Manzu's work, Italia, which is a bronze work. It was installed in May 1965. It depicts cut vines, grape leaves, wheat stalks, and it symbolizes the fruitfulness, the productivity of Italy. And what's interesting about this work, even if you don't know a lot about the time period or Art Deco, you could be walking around Rockefeller Center and glance up at this work, and it sticks out that it doesn't belong to the 1930s. It's very different. We don't see that curly Q kind of design happening that we see with the 30s work. It's very minimal and quiet in its approach, though it's a really beautiful work in relationship to the building. The bronze is very, the patina on the bronze is quite beautiful against the limestone. Now, Isamu Noguchi's work, and really well-known artist, and it's a work from 1940, and of course he'll become much more well-known for his completely abstract works. And here's a figurative work with definitely abstract approach to representing the figure. It's a stainless steel work installed in April 1940 called News, and it went into 50 Rockefeller Plaza, and the original tenant was the Associated Press, which is not true today. Okay, so but the artwork still stays. And that this is the only piece in the whole complex that was chosen through a competition. And he's showing the tools of the News. What's so fascinating about this work in our present day is how dated those tools of the News are for 2008. If you look up here, if you look up here, the camera. We no longer look through one eye. We use two eyes now with digital technology, and that only changed within the last few years. Teletype machine. Okay, we don't have computers here, just a basic notepad. Look at the phone, you know, when phones lasted forever. Okay, and the lines right over here for transmitting information. And it was assembled in sections. You can see the lines of the piece, the way it goes together. And again, that stainless steel, and actually the architects had been talking about stainless steel in relationship to the building or something modern, putting a different kind of material in the building. And that works very well, too, with the Indiana limestone. Lee Lori, this is 30 Rock, and I'm calling it the address of the building, 30 Rockefeller Plaza. The plaza that cuts through Rockefeller Center is a private street that was developed by the complex, one of the few private streets, I think, in Midtown. And this is the tallest building. This was Rockefeller's building. The 56th floor was the Rockefeller floor. This is his office. And so for 30 Rock, we have Lee Lori's work. And the work in the center is Wisdom. And sometimes it goes by the name Wisdom, a voice from the clouds, So different kinds of names circulate around him. And the two figures that flank him, we have sound right over here, and we have light right over here. And this piece that unifies all three of them on the bottom using Pyrex glass blocks that actually are really, they look beautiful from the outside, but one of the pluses by installing those is that it lights up the front entranceway as well. So the work is made out of polychrome painted in gilded limestone and cast glass blocks with gilding. And one of the things that Salon, the man who was in charge for coordinating the artworks on the outside of the buildings, he had become familiar with a kind of paint that was used in Germany that could be used on limestone, that it lay on top of the limestone, but it also sank into the limestone. And where it was installed in Germany was on an area near water where it had survived the elements. And he chose to use that in Rockefeller Center. And you can go down there and see how beautiful the colors still are. And you can see how the colors work with the piece near the International Building as well. There's definitely a harmony. Now, of course, the artist did weigh in on the discussions for the color, but there was somebody else who was also coordinating it as well. And with wisdom, you have the quote below it from, you can see right here, there's a quote engraved right above the entranceway. And it's from Isaiah, and it reads as follows, "Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times." And, you know, there was a lot, you can still look for pictures. There is a period where they left, you can see early pictures of this entranceway where there is no quote. And what happened with that area is J.D. Rockefeller Jr. was very concerned what went on the front entranceway to 30 Rock. This is where his office was located. And he was very, just to give you a closer look of the work, to show you that glass work and the beautiful detailing of wisdom. And also, I'd like to point this out as well. Wisdom was based on a William Blake work. He was the main image of William. Excuse me, the main image of wisdom, that figure holding the compass. The image Laurie based it on, if you look over on your left, is a William Blake image called The Ancient of Days from 1794, where the figure is holding the compass as well. But getting back to the reasons that it took a while to settle on that Isaiah quote, you know, Rockefeller Jr. was very, very disturbed by the artwork that went up over the 49th Street entranceway and the 50th Street entranceway to 30 Rock. They're Leo Freelander works. The title of both works is called Transmission. The image you're looking at here is one of the images from Radio, which hangs over the 50th Street entrance. And Rockefeller Jr. did not like these works. He thought the figures were ugly and unbeautiful. He actually talked to John Todd asking to have them removed. It just was too expensive. The artist didn't want to make changes. So Rockefeller held very, very strong about what would go over his main entranceway for that quote. They went through quite a few quotes before they all agreed on Isaiah. And again, when I say all agreed, I'm talking about Rockefeller, I'm talking about Laurie, and I'm talking about the architects. Everything's going through committee, okay? Now, the other thing, too, we have with this work are the two figures that flank wisdom, sound and light. And they're quite beautiful. And they actually represent RCA went in there, Radio Corporation of America, and representing the two technologies, radio for sound, light for transmitting motion pictures. Television is going to be a booming business that's coming out of 30 Rock. So it's another way of looking at these works as well. So the big controversy that happens in 30 Rock. To give you an idea, 30 Rockefeller, you know, 30 Rockefeller Plaza was the main building, and there was a huge debate about the artists who would get the commission in 30 Rockefeller Plaza. And they actually settled on three artists to handle the works in 30 Rock. The three artists were, and you're looking at one of them, is Diego Rivera. Rivera will take the main wall. That's the wall when you first walk in the building. Two other artists were hired to do the side corridors. One on the south, one on the north. And the one that is on the north is Jose Maria Sert, and the one who is on the south is Frank Bronwyn. Sert from Spain, Bronwyn from England. But Diego Rivera gets the center mural. And originally the three artists they contacted was Rivera, and they also asked Picasso and Matisse to participate. Matisse turned down the offer, though he will later work for the Rockefeller family, but Picasso never responded to a wire he received from one of the Todd's because it was addressed to Pierre Picasso. So that was something that would not happen. Remember, Edward Trumbull had been hired to organize and coordinate all the interior artworks. And what he wanted to do and what he decided to do for the interior artworks is that Sirt and Bronwyn, who will be doing the side works, the side quarters, were asked to work in pre-primed canvas. That means canvas was sent to their studios in Europe that had already been painted. They were told how to work. They were to work in a limited palette, blacks and browns and whites. They were supposed to work in chiaroscuro, so it would be intense darks and lights. This was so that the works would hold together as one in the lobby. That was something everyone was concerned of. Now, Diego Rivera was known for his incredible murals and his colors, and Diego Rivera was allowed to create a fresco in the front wall. And when you do a fresco, you're literally working into wet plaster. Your artwork is permanently in and of the wall. And he was a master at fresco because you have to work as the plaster dries. So you have a limited amount of time as you put down the imagery. Now, Diego Rivera was very good friends with Abby Aldrich Rockefeller. She had been collecting his work. Nelson Rockefeller had been collecting his work. He had an exhibition. Rivera had an exhibition here in 31. J.D. Rockefeller Jr. did not like modern art. He left that to Abby and Nelson. That was not his thing, okay? So Diego Rivera most likely got the commission through Abby and Nelson. Very well-known artist at the time, a man of loud opinions, a large man physically, and a large man in what he brought forth to the world. His political views were not unknown to anybody who was aware of who Diego Rivera was. He had been in the Communist Party. At the time he was hired to do the mural at Rockefeller Center, he had actually been thrown out of the Communist Party. Now, the way that it worked at Rockefeller Center, you want to remember everything's going through committee, and they're also signing contracts with the complex when they make a piece of art, which actually gave Rockefeller Center the ownership of the artwork. And also, they are also submitting a proposal which will have a sketch or a photo of what they intend to do, and also a description of the work intended for the lobby and intended for the complex. And the theme that was given to Diego Rivera, because the artists were given themes to represent. Remember, there was a theme uniting the whole thing. They were passed kind of a vague theme to represent in the work. And for Diego Rivera, the theme he received is as follows. Man at a crossroads, looking with uncertainty, but with hope and high vision towards a new and better future. And today, we often refer to this work as Man at a Crossroads. And he does submit a sketch. It's signed off on, okay? Everybody agrees to it. And he begins to work on his mural in 30 Rock. The image right here is with him and his wife, Frida Kahlo, also an artist as well, up on the scaffolding in 30 Rock. And you want to think about the situation at 30 Rockefeller Center when he's hired to do this. He starts in... He arrives in April 1933 to start. Supposedly, the building is set to be open on May 1st. They're working quite fast. The building isn't ready yet, so he's in the main lobby. The building is still being worked on. If you're unfamiliar with the main lobby of 30 Rock, walk inside it. There's a mezzanine area as you walk in. It's a very big lobby. And he had actually set up a studio, like a little shed where he had a phone, where he looked at his sketches. It was right on the mezzanine area. So you have this whole drama happening in the main lobby. They're working on the building. He's working on the mural. He's got his little studio there. People are coming to the lobby and actually watching him make this mural as well. And again, he's working in fresco, and he's working around the clock trying to finish it for the May 1st opening. Now, what happens, at some point they become aware he's included an image of Lenin, okay? That does not go over well in a Rockefeller building. And the big debate is whether he included the image of Lenin in that sketch that he submitted to the committee, or did he... Or was it not included in that sketch? Now, Lucien Bloch, who was working as one of his assistants at the time, working on the mural, and she was also keeping a diary, wrote that the adding of Lenin was an afterthought. That's what she writes in her memories of this experience. When they become aware that Lenin's in the lobby, it does become an issue. And Nelson will write a letter asking him to remove the image of Lenin. And Diego Rivera says no. But he has a few ideas, and one of those ideas is he offers to put an image of Lincoln in there, of a great American as well. That does not go over very well. The idea of Lincoln and Lenin doesn't work, go over well. And you want to remember, too, this is the lobby that J.D. Rockefeller Jr., this is the entrance he will choose to come in to. He doesn't like the side entrances. They don't agree to the Lincoln-Lenin idea. And eventually he will... They want that Lenin removed, and eventually Rivera will write a letter that he will submit to the complex. And actually, he did not write it himself. It was written by Ben Shawn, you know, with Rivera's approval. And Ben Shawn, an artist who was working as an assistant on the mural, there were quite a few people working on the mural with him. And the sentence that I'd like to read to you from that letter is, "Therefore, rather than mutilate the conception, I should prefer the physical destruction of the concept in its entirety, but preserving at least its integrity." Meaning he did not want to remove Lenin. He considered that it would be destroying the work. He'd rather see the work destroyed than remove what he chose to put in it. And that sentence leads to, in what happens is May 9th, 1933, the building does not open May 1st. Rivera is dismissed. He's given a check for the balance of what he was owed. He was agreed that he would be paid $21,000. He had already received $7,000. And he is given a balance for that, the rest of it. So he's paid in full. The work is covered up with tar paper. There you go. And I want to point this out to you. See the image right over here? Today, a CERT mural hangs there, but that was also part of Rivera's work, too. Okay, so here's our main lobby right there. And it was covered up with tar paper. Eventually, they're going to cover it up with canvas. And what happens late at night, on February 9th, 1934, it was a Saturday night, the fresco was destroyed. And there were protests that took place outside of 30 Rock. Now, there had been discussion of maybe moving the mural over to the Museum of Modern Art. And I don't know if one of the reasons that they might have, it did not happen, is because it was a fresco. It isn't easy to move a fresco. It is literally in the wall. The complex issues a sentence, a statement after the destruction. The Rivera mural has been removed from the walls of the RCA building and the space replastered. The removal involved the destruction of the mural. And I can tell you today, this happened in 1934. There are still people who run into that lobby asking you where the Diego Rivera is. And I'm a former tour guide, art and architecture tour guide from Rock Center. I know this for a fact. It wasn't up there very long. It didn't last very long. But people still look for it. Now, what happens a year later is Diego Rivera will recreate from memory and sketches his version, another version of Man at the Crossroads at the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City, where you can see it today. Again, it's a fresco, and again, it follows the similar planning and composition from the original work. He does include Marx in it, okay? He does change what Marx is wearing in there. Excuse me, not Marx, Lenin, I apologize. Lenin in there, and Lenin grasping the hands of the people that surround him. And he does include in that work as well what we have over here. If looking at these figures, we have Trotsky right over here. We have Engels and Marx. Marx is holding a book that's open. And this is something that was not, to my knowledge, included in the original mural. He adds this in here. And holding that book in Marx's hand right over here, it reads as follows: "The liberation of the workers may only be the work of the laborers themselves." And what you... okay, let me just move along right here. He does make another change in the mural down in Mexico City. This was included in the original mural in 30 Rock. There was four women playing cards right over here. And what you see over here is this big ellipse shape where you had different germs and diseases. If you follow it up, there's disease and germs representing syphilis and gonorrhea. But he does make a change to the one that he includes in Mexico City. He chooses to include J.D. Rockefeller Jr. in this area. And he's holding a cocktail. And Rockefeller Jr. did not drink. Okay, so there you go. A brief story. I think there's a lot of gray areas to the story. Why did he had to know that Rockefeller could not live with Lenin in the lobby? He just had to know that. On the other hand, they knew who Diego Rivera was when they hired him. I mean, the fact that he chose to have a certain political viewpoint in his work was not a surprise to anybody involved who knew who Diego Rivera was. So a lot of gray areas to that story. Anyways. here's what happens to the main mural. This is Diego Rivera and Jose Maria Sert. Sert, one of the original artists who was hired to do the corridor works in 1933 up on the scaffolding in front of Rivera's work. You can see they are different types of artists. He, Sert, was a more a social type of artist. A well-known artist, but different kind of artist, did not have the same political views as Diego Rivera. And he eventually will get the commission for the main wall. Now, for a while, the architects would meet weekly discussing what to do with that main wall. They called it the Wailing Wall. Everybody pitched ideas, including J.D. Rockefeller Jr. They thought of other artists that had been hired to work in the complex. In the end, they choose Sert. And Sert will again work on a canvas, an oil on canvas that fits within the color scheme. I only have the black and white image, but it's, just to show you, this is the work on the ceiling. And it's a little orangey in this image. It's a little more yellow in the lobby, So it's in yellow tones. It's a limited palette. It's oil on canvas glued on the wall. Okay, so they could remove it should they choose to without destroying the work. And of course, when they decide to hire Sert for the main lobby, he is sent a model, which he has to do the exact replica of what he intends to put in the main lobby. They don't want any surprises this time. And he does American Progress. And it hangs behind the front desk today. And here we have Lincoln, we have Ralph Waldo Emerson, and we have Rockefeller Center, 30 Rock, right in the background. And then this is representing labor. This is supposedly representing the arts. There's this big void here, but it fits within his other works that are included in the lobby. Now, the other work that he is probably one of his best work, I think, in the lobby is the work that he puts on the ceiling. And the work that's on the ceiling is called Time. It's by Jose Maria Sert. And again, it is canvas that is glued on the wall, which is an amazing way to work when you think about it, or glued on the ceiling. It's over 5,000 square feet of canvas with adhesive keeping it up there. When you go to the lobby, go look at it and go look up. Particularly if you walk to the sides, you can see through the lighting. You can see that they had to match up the lines of the canvas to get it on the ceiling, which must have been tough. And you have those two major columns in the lobby as well. And remember, he's working in Europe, and then it's sent over here. And Sert did come over for much of the installation. So I'm assuming he was here for this installation as well. And he knew this lobby because the work is called Time, and you have this large figure that straddles the two main columns that's representing the present, and he's holding a huge balance in his arms. Now, the work closest to the north side of the city, you'll see an hourglass that represents the past, and then if you walk towards the south side of the building, you'll see an hourglass that represents the future. Now, there's an optical illusion that occurs in the lobby when you look at this work, which is really amazing. And you know Sert was aware that it would happen. What happens? Let's say you start on the north side of the building in the past. Then you walk across the lobby and you look up as you walk. And what you'll see happen is you'll see the weight of his legs shift. Now it's bent on this side, but when you get to the other side and look, this knee is bent. It really happens. You see it shift from past to present. It's an optical illusion that works because we move and the image stands still. And he knew it would happen. Okay? So the other things I want you to do when you go visit Rock Center, watch that happen and then look at the way it was installed, that they had to match up this canvas. The lobby was actually changed to handle this artwork in terms of they changed the lighting so that it would work for the public as they stood on the bottom and looked at the work. Now, the third artist that was included from the beginning was Frank Bronwyn. And the theme that he had was the overriding theme, because he has four canvases that go on the elevator banks on the south quarter. And the overriding theme for all those four works is Man in Search for Eternal Truth. And the work we're looking at is the one that's closest to Fifth Avenue, the last one, Sermon on the Mount, which was installed in 1933. And again, he was working on canvas, oil on canvas. He was given the instructions by Trumbull. What happens is, and I only have the black and white image, his work did look different. It didn't have the same energy as Sert's work. And supposedly Trumbull did do a little touching up on the works to try to get them to go together. But there is still debate that the works don't work as well together. And what he did for his works, he has text included in all four of his paintings, which were the writings of Philip Macker Wright, who was a friend of the artist. artist. And McElroy wrote about the theme that he had for these four paintings, and it reads as follows. Man in his search for truth and happiness must learn to accept the fundamental teachings of Christ. Now, one of the members on the art committee of Rockefeller Center, there was an art committee assembled after they lost Burr Alexander, and the art committee did include professionals from the art world, and one of them was H.E. Winlop from the Met. And he did write a letter saying, one of the sentences from his letter, he did write saying, I do not believe the introduction of Christ into a business building is in the best taste. You know, there was still controversy going on in the lobby. What they will do is they will send Trumbull to visit Bronwyn in England. And Bronwyn was not doing so well health-wise while he was working on these commissions. And he agrees to change the imagery, but he will not agree to change the text. The text he keeps the same. And what you see on Sermon on the Mount is you see that image of Christ up top, but he doesn't face us. Okay? But the statement at the bottom, which is right over here, is man, it reads as follows, man's ultimate destiny depends not on whether he can learn new lessons or make new discoveries and conquests, but his acceptance of lessons taught him close upon 2,000 years ago. Okay, so he stayed within his original theme. Now, Rockefeller Center continues to showcase contemporary art in its complex, which is great, because you have people seeing contemporary art and they might not visit the Museum of Modern Art, but they might visit Rockefeller Center, even though we're both so close. And this work just came down. I don't know if you saw it. It's by Tim Noble and Sue Webster, British artists, called Electric Fountain, where they recreated a running fountain in LED lights. And a fountain is something where we're well known to see in public complexes. Of course, we have that beautiful fountain behind Prometheus. And where it's set up, if you're unfamiliar with Rockefeller Center, go to Fifth Avenue, right across from Saks Fifth Avenue, and gaze down the Channel Gardens. Now, we call it the Channel Gardens because the gardens are bordered by the French and British building, and the press nicknamed it after the English Channel, okay? The original name was the Promenade Gardens, but we, you know, the nickname stuck, the Channel Gardens, and everything lines up, 30 Rock, Prometheus, the gardens, it's beautiful, and the artwork that they installed will line up with it, too. It's where the Christmas tree stands. It was a piece that changed as, you know, the sky changed from the sun going down. It looked different at night than it did in the day. Other works that have been installed in that area is Puppy by Jeff Koons, which was you had an inner system that watered these plants. You had different flowers that grew. They got shaggier as the flowers grew, and when you'd see them being watered, you could see the puppy dripping maybe from his tongue, standing where the Christmas tree stands. Another piece by Takashi Murakami. This is just one element of his installation, Reverse Double Helix, and you see the eye balloons that floated over the skating rink, slightly rocking back and forth. And the view where this shot was taken is where, let's say, Prometheus is right below on the rink, and where this shot is we're standing where Puppy was located. So we're looking right at Saks, that beautiful eye going right up at Saks. And the last one I want to leave you with, which was a contemporary piece installed there, though there have been others, is the Jonathan Borowski piece, Walking to the Sky, which was made out of steel and aluminum. These figures walking up into the sky. It's definitely a work that's open to interpretation. I often saw it as for the many reasons people move to New York for their dreams and whatever they have in mind when they come to the city. And nice to see it in Rockefeller Center. And again, this too was installed in the main area where the Christmas tree stands. So Rockefeller Center is really here to stay. They built it to last, and it will last. So thank you.